You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There is a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for March 13th, 2015. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from Car Talk for Liberals, it's The Professional Left with Drift Glass and Blue Gal.
Trademark violation implied.
No.
One of our face-to-face friends who listens to the podcast said, "You guys are Car Talk for Liberals."
This is awesome. You guys are awesome. I like Car Talk for Liberals. And I'm not doing their voice either. I'm just doing
That's it. We were tickled by that. So thank you.
And we are. I mean, if we weren't the professional left, we might just go with Car Talk for Liberals.
Well, but then you got to talk about a Dodge Dart. Who is the Dodge Dart of politics?
That's Tom a good
Cotton.
Question. Tom Cotton. Yeah.
Tom Cotton is the Dodge Dart.
No, okay. I think he's more of a roadmaster because no matter how
Marco
many.
Marco Rubio is a Dodge Dart.
Well, no matter how many accidents he gets in, only his occupants are killed. You just hose him. You can just hose him off and roll him right back on the road and he'll go off and kill more people. But yeah, I think Marco Rubio is the Dodge Dart of politics. Although they're all unstoppable. I mean, really, they're just, I don't want to jump into the podcast.
Oh, no, let's just jump into the podcast because John McCain signs lots of letters.
He does. He signs many letters. I sign many things. And then it's pudding time and then Matlock. And so,
who was that paper boy who handed me that piece of paper? Oh, that was Tom Cotton. Oh, I thought it was the paper boy, as one person on Twitter pointed out.
Yeah.
He thought it was the paper boy.
I thought he wanted an autograph from me.
This is the problem with having senators for life.
Well,
first of all.
Yeah, please.
He's too old.
He's too old.
McCain's too old, period. And I'm not being ageist here. He needs to retire.
Right.
And for his own, go enjoy the golf course and time with your family and what normal retired people do. Uh-huh. You have all the money in the world. Go retire and enjoy yourself. Mm-hmm. But the implication of this letter was, look, we're U.S. senators and we're going to be here for fucking ever.
Right.
And
right.
Barack Obama's out in 2017 and you'll have to deal with us, Iran, mullahs, forever. And I don't know about you, but to me, when I read this letter, it reminded me so much of when you remember when Rand Paul went to Howard University.
Oh,
I was going to lay down some truth on him about race and Republicans.
He's just here to rap with the black kids about truth.
Yeah. And it he pulled had up that a smarmy, patronizing. Yeah. We think we need to explain to you about our constitutional system. And the Iranians were like, well, we think we need to explain to you about international law, but we're going to give up now.
Yeah. Yeah. No, for those of you who don't remember, this was Rand Paul going to Howard University, I believe. Said, I don't know if a lot of you kids know this, but the black people were helped a lot by Republicans back in the day. And they're just like, fuck you. Do you know where you are? Have you taken any history class here? Have you seen any curriculum for any courses being offered here? And he's like, oh, I just didn't know. I didn't know if you knew.
There isn't a person in this room that doesn't have a 1300 SAT. Fuck you. Yeah.
Well, and no, exactly. And this is the very dangerous place that Republicans go when they go out, you know, in public.
In public, yeah.
Without a leash on, without a muzzle on, this is why I just gave up on debating conservatives a long time ago. There's this history gap between 1962, roughly, and yesterday, where they don't remember anything. Nothing happened, nothing. It was just unknown territory, a bunch of gray space. No one's quite sure what happened. There was a moment there when Reagan came along, and then he ascended bodily to heaven. Mm-hmm. And then a bunch of other stuff happened, and we're pretty sure there was this bipartisan agreement to go to war in Iraq. And it was everybody's fault, really. And then Barack Obama came around and destroyed everything. That's how they remember history. And I'm not being facetious. If you argue with a conservative, you will find that they have lobotomized themselves to the point where they do not remember anything. Before 1962, they have a master's degree in history, in race history in America. They can tell you every Democrat who was ever part of any group in the South. They can tell you all about Robert Byrd. They can tell you everything. But suddenly their memory goes completely white. Yes. Right about the time the Voting Rights Act was signed. And they remember nothing. Because if they were forced to remember what had happened since they were 4 years old, they would have to reconcile themselves with the fact that they have joined voluntarily and stayed with voluntarily a party of racists and morons and imbeciles and lunatics.
Well, and that it wasn't a matter of party. It was a matter of white supremacy.
Exactly.
And that the white supremacists would go to whatever party was going to suck the dick of white supremacy. It didn't matter.
And
they Richard wound Nixon up said, being Republicans.
Hey, I have an idea. Let's turn the party of Lincoln into the party of Jefferson Davis. Yeah. And it worked. But they can't reconcile that historical reality. Charlie Pierce said something today that I said in 2007, which was if the bigots and the white supremacists, if the base basically went away, if the crazy people that they're everyone's complaining about went away, there'd be nothing left of the Republican Party but five rich guys bitching about marginal tax rates at a country club.
Yep.
There just wouldn't be.
It'd be William F. Buckley and his five friends. That's it. Yeah.
That's who the party is. And they can't admit that. And so when they go out in public, they risk running into people, and Rand Paul has mastered the strategy of dealing with this by running hell the opposite direction. But they risk running into people who aren't brainwashed or morons. And so there's Rand Paul in front of an audience of people who goddamn well know well and good what the actual history in Black America is, going back several centuries to some degree of detail. And he's very used to arguing with libertarians who skip over that whole five-decade-long period when the Republican Party assimilated the white supremacists on purpose.
Basically our entire lifetime, yeah.
And so he's not used to dealing with people who aren't already drunk on the same dumbass Kool-Aid that he's drunk on. And that brings us back to John McCain, who, if he will sign anything, someone, for God's sake, slip him a political career DNR immediately.
Do not resuscitate this guy's Senate career, please.
Because the next time he steps on a rake, sorry, we got to pull the plug on you, Senator. Go with God, go be on the golf course, go someplace else. But the thing is, Lindsey Graham will still be there.
Oh, yeah. No, there's a million of them. You know, behind the 47 senators, there's at least 87 people ready to run, ready to primary somebody, ready to, you know, they're churning them out over at Koch headquarters.
Yeah.
Grooming them to be leadership in this party that serves the needs of billionaires. That's it.
And that's
one thing I'm finding really interesting, about the 47 traitors thing is how quickly the right-wing media machine stepped away from this.
Yeah.
Understanding that, no, this is not little league baseball. This is big time. And this is the nuclear bomb. And this is negotiating a delicate treaty to make sure that the Iranians don't have a nuclear weapon. We're going to try to do it diplomatically. We know the Saudis are watching us and want us to do this right. And they're and so forth. And so people like Charles Krauthammer and Tom Friedman, first of all, how come these senators didn't ask Charles Krauthammer?
Because Tom Cotton got to them first and said, hey, I got a clever idea. I got a really clever idea. You know what will make Barack Obama look really stupid?
And liberals mad. This will make liberals mad.
Where do I sign?
We're going to embarrass John Kerry. This will be good. Yeah. No. And it wasn't. And I don't know if you saw John Kerry speaking in front of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee with Marco Rubio, dumber than a bag of hammers, Marco Rubio, who is very forceful in his stupid questioning. He is insistent that the Iranians, our allies, don't like what we're doing. And John Kerry just said, that is categorically false. I spoke to. And then he starts rattling off the names of every one of his counterparts in the Sunni world that is working with us.
Yes.
I met with him. I met with him last week. We had a press conference together. We did this. We did that. And I mean, what can Marco Rubio do at that point except sputter?
Well, that's where they have to stay in Fox world. At any point where they intersect with anyone who's going to ask them or push back on them or challenge them or say, you know what, that's just completely fucking wrong. They have learned the hard way by stepping on a million rakes to just stay the hell away from those people. But in the end, it doesn't matter.
You've been reading 10 Grain, I can tell. Rake stepper. Nancy Pelosi visiting Syria is not the same thing.
No, I'm sorry.
First of all, she went there to try to bring some peace and understanding to the situation, not to divide.
No.
Not to divide the government. And secondly, she did not write to him and say, by the way, you can ignore everything the president is saying.
Yeah, that knucklehead.
He won't be here in 2 years, so, and I will. So, you know, just forget about it. Yeah, no, that did not happen.
No.
I want you to talk about Tom Friedman, because you wrote about this, and I laughed and laughed and laughed.
Oh, Lord. It is weird, and in a cosmic sense, it's hilarious to watch the staggeringly small number of people who have a huge influence over what we say and do. Mm-hmm. And to hear Tom Friedman, who still is allowed to write about Iraq, still is allowed to write. And my post, I titled it, I Hate It When Billionaire Mommy and Daddy Fight. As everyone knows,
everyone needs to go and read. This was my favorite Driftless post of the week. Yeah.
And I got to say, I did a few that made me laugh that I thought were good. David Brooks' post is pretty good too. But Tom Friedman, who is the New York Times accountability free billionaire op-ed columnist, who was only too happy to lend his tremendously powerful media platforms to the cause of shoving us into a completely ill-considered war with Iraq, is really pissed that accountability-free billionaire casino mogul Sheldon Adelson is pushing us towards a reckless war with Iran at the bidding of GOP and Bibi Netanyahu.
Yeah.
And Tom Friedman... of all people, first of all, just shut up, Tom. Just shut up. Please shut up. You have all the money you could ever want. You could have more money than your family could spend in 10 generations. Go away. And if you're not going to go away, please, for fuck's sake, stop writing about the Middle East. Stop it. It's embarrassing. You know what? And the thing is, I agree with what he's saying here.
Oh, I do too. Agree with what he's saying,
but
it's really dangerous to have one billionaire Zionist deciding that what's best for Israel is what my money will pay for, and I'm going to buy these senators to run the foreign policy of the United States.
Yeah. Although, as we learned with Tom Cotton, and we're getting a little ahead of ourselves, it is in the long run much more efficient to simply breed people like this than to bribe them. Bribery is so iffy. Someone might come along with a bigger bag of money, or they might suddenly grow a conscience, and then where are you? But with Tom Cotton, people like Tom Cotton and Paul Ryan, you just breed them for this. Mm-hmm. From the youngest age, this is like something out of Brave New World.
Yeah.
You breed them from birth.
From model legislature onward, yes.
Be libertarian, wingnut, conscienceless assholes.
When if you can get them at 15, they are naturally libertarian because, you know, they haven't grown pubes yet, so you're in good shape.
And they're the smartest person in the world, because every 15-year-old is.
Yeah.
And they don't have and they're selfish, and you teach them, don't grow out of this. This is the way all of life should be. And you throw a lot of money at them. And over the course of decades, it's much cheaper to breed up these people because, again, when one breaks down, you supplant them with another. So you have – anyway, getting back to Shelley Adelson, it is hilarious. What cracks me up about this is Tom Friedman writing about Sheldon Adelson as if he's made some sort of discovery. As if out there in the desert, he has discovered the tomb of Tutankhamun, and he needs to tell people about what's going on out there. You know, he's very indignant that Shelley Adelson wants to use his power to push Israel and America towards a war, and then he wants to defund the Palestinian Authority and towards a confrontation with Iran. Not a diplomatic solution. And Tom Friedman says, people need to know this. And my response was impolitely, who needs to know this? What people are you talking about? Liberals? Fuck you.
Yes.
We've been warning about this for years, and nobody listens. Nobody listens. And so, great, you finally fucking noticed that the Republican Party is funded by lunatic crackpot right-wing billionaires. Good for you, Tom. Here's a cookie. Now shut up and go away. Or what other people could you be talking about? Conservatives? Conservatives are lining up from here to New Jersey to kiss Sheldon Adelson's ass.
Absolutely.
When Chris Christie accidentally called Palestine the occupied territory, he had to go back and grovel for Shelley Adelson money.
Yep.
And that's what they do. It's just like Rush Limbaugh. You accidentally piss this guy off, so they go back. So who might you be talking about? The 50% of the people in this country who could not be less interested in politics if you offered them blowjobs and cheese doodles to go vote.
Mm-hmm.
No. Mm-hmm. Who are you addressing this letter to? Who is it that doesn't already know this? And the idea that Tom Friedman, Tom, suck on this Friedman.
Suck
Tom.
On this. No, that was the whole point, is that he was the one who said, we had to go to any random country in the Middle East and show them who was boss, right?
Sure. And you know what? We had to kick in some doors and say, suck on this. That was his answer to sending other people's children off to die.
Yep.
You know, hiding behind his billions and sending other people's children off to die. And now... Now he's writing, people who go all the way like this will one day go over a cliff. They will regret it. So will the rest of us. And I just can't help but think that the only reason Tom Friedman wasn't blown to atoms by a lightning bolt is that God herself was laughing so hard it fucked up her aim.
Exactly.
Because, oh my. So, and then I put in there in between. By the way, David Brooks has been too busy lecturing the poors on having bad values to weigh in on this, but... On the one hand, he was one of the people who helped, like Tom Friedman, shove this country into the George Bush Iraqi debacle. On the other hand, his son works for Bibi Netanyahu. So I can hardly wait for his opinion to show up on here. But take a giant step back. You have these three people with more influence over the lives of hundreds of millions of Americans than you and I and every liberal in the electorate will have in seven lifetimes. And that's what's so... fucked up about the system. I'm saying that word a lot today and I apologize, but that's what's so completely ass backwards about the system, that a clown, an asshole with $1 billion like Shelley Adelson and a buffoon like Tom Friedman and a hack like David Brooks could have this enormous amount of influence over our system and be wrong most of the time and be completely wrong most of the time and never be held accountable for any of it. Nobody turns away Shelley Adelson's money because he's a vicious old crackpot. Nobody fires Tom Friedman. Nobody walks into David Brooks' office and puts a letter on the desk and says, you don't have a job here anymore because you've been wrong just one too many goddamn times.
Yeah, yeah.
That never happens. Never happens. And yet these are the people who opine about what other people should do, about the values other people should follow, about how other people need to really be held accountable for shit because that's how this country got screwed up in the first place. And that's what makes it so cosmically amusing to me.
And just to add a PS to what you said about David Brooks' son working for Bibi Netanyahu, there's an article in Slate this week about, and I've just been trying to figure a lot of these things out, trying to find what is in Israeli election law as to whether Bibi Netanyahu can own stock in Israeli defense corporations.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't find out much about that, but... It is legal in Israel for foreigners to invest money or to donate money to political campaigns. Mm-hmm. And 90% of Benjamin Netanyahu's campaign money comes from the United States. It comes from five families.
Mm-hmm.
And you know who they are.
they're the Tataglia.
It's not Shelley Adelson by name, but definitely by temperament.
Yeah.
And multimillionaires who... and. I loved what John Fugelsang had a picture of the anti-Netanyahu protests in Tel Aviv. It's like, why do these people hate Israel? What kind of stock does Tom Cotton own?
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
He's been speaking for defense contractors at their private little getaways, you know, their defense contractor lobbyist getaways. Crooks and Liars had an article about one such event where he spoke for, you know, whatever fee he got.
Uh-huh.
And then I realized, you know what? It really doesn't matter whether Tom Cotton owns stock in these defense corporations. They own stock in him.
Exactly. And that's so the point.
The point. Yeah.
They have built him to spec.
Yeah.
And he's performing exactly as function, same way Scott Walker's performing as function, as designed.
Mm-hmm.
Go right down the line. The same way our own new Governor Hedge Fund, that's a little one for you, Ryan, is performing exactly as advertised.
Speaking of shout outs to various correspondents, we got a letter from Gary. We actually got a nice gift from Gary, and there's no return address on it, so I don't know who to write to thank. But Gary put a letter in with his present to us and said that the only quid pro quo he wanted was he wanted you to say David fucking Brooks on the air. So have you done that yet?
Excuse me. David fucking Brooks.
Yeah. There's your quid pro quo.
David fucking can bite my shiny metal liberal ass.
Well, and I thought it was so fascinating that Paul Krugman sort of did a reach around to punch David Brooks in the nuts.
Yeah. It was a one bank shot. It was not a five bank shot. Yeah, it was he linked to an article that itself said basically David Brooks. Yeah. But see, the thing is, here's the thing about the, and I know this is one of the things I harp on and I apologize, but.
No, but this is going to lead us into a discussion about your layoff because people know that Drift Glass was laid off this week. It's been a very stressful week for both of us.
It has.
I've had to deal with the insurance companies and trying to get health insurance. We'll talk about a little bit about that in a minute.
But
to what David Brooks tried to say this week, or what his argument was about poor people and values and what happens to people when their values don't allow them to behave the way we think they should.
Right.
And I'm going to let you reiterate Paul Krugman's article about this.
Well, it was not just Paul. Wasn't just Paul Krugman. And I'm
scrolling
down.
A lot of people after him. Yeah.
I'm scrolling down here real quick because I want to make sure I get the full rich coffee flavor of because I wrote a long post called "Outside the Alexandria Safe Zone" with David Brooks, and the first part's about being laid off and how much that sucks and how it's getting hard. But the second part was about, and imagine my delight when I open up the paper just to find David Brooks talking about the most unaccountable person in American journalism decrying the lack of accountability among poor people. And imagine my joy in reading the king of pathological both-siderism, earning that sweet, sweet New York Times dollar by lecturing everyone in America on the horrors of not being judgmental enough.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, the idea that David Brooks, who has never taken ownership or responsibility for a single syllable of the pro-war, hippie-punching, revisionist schlock he peddles to pay the rent, demanding that people, unspecified quote-unquote people, be held responsible for stuff, you know? Mm-hmm. They should be held responsible for things. That was his entire column. It was about how those people over there have bad values. And it's not their fault. It's just the result of this moral relativism where nobody ever judges whether something's right or wrong, whether something's good or bad, blah, blah, blah. And if we just got back to holding people generically accountable for stuff generically, everything would be fine. We don't need more social programs. We don't need more training. We don't need more money thrown at poor people. They just need to get their values in order. And on most days, working the David Brooks beat is lonely. Nobody does it. Nobody wants to do it because there's no upside to it. David Brooks is a force of nature. There's nothing that's going to dislodge him from his position. There's nobody at PBS who's ever going to say, you're a lying sack of shit. Nobody at NPR is going to throw a drink in his face. Chuck Todd's never going to slap him on Meet the Press. No one's ever.
Well,
ever
it is a puzzlement as to why he holds such power, because people actually, as we've said before, audibly gasp when someone does step out of line and say, no, David Brooks is wrong about everything on Morning Joe. It is unbelievable. And so he has some power.
Tremendous. He has a and it's power they gave him.
Yeah.
He's been handed an enormous amount of clout in the media world, and he uses it to shovel this centrist, both-siderist, both-sides-do-it schlock. And he made a point in a previous column. People have been wondering why I've gone off in this sort of spiritual, moral thing. And here's the thing. So let me tell you, the Brooks beat is a lonely beat, usually.
Mm-hmm.
But this week, for whatever reason, it got really crowded. There's Charlie Pierce, again, sounding a lot like Drift Glass, but to his credit, he is an original writer who just happens to sound a lot like me, which I find reassuring. It means for no other reason. It means that, you know what? I really can play in that league. If I ever got invited
to
the majors
out there,
I could do it. It's not like this is an impossible thing. If the shot ever came, I could take it and I could not embarrass my family. But Pierce did it. Matt Taibbi wrote the same column. New Republic wrote the same column. Dean Baker wrote the same column. And most importantly and most hilariously, Paul Krugman wrote the same column. And he wrote it in a brutally blunt and quick way. It was, if only someone had conducted a social experiment to see which comes first, economic deprivation and the loss of jobs, or the collapse of orderly society and morals.
And if we turns could do out, an experiment.
Turns out we did have an experiment. Yeah. If only there was some like similarly situated group of, let's say, white people without high school, without college degrees. Mm-hmm. And you took away all their middle class jobs and watched what happened to them. He said, actually, that's exactly what happened. You know what you had? Skyrocketing teen pregnancy, skyrocketing alcoholism, skyrocketing drug use, mm-hmm. skyrocketing crime rates. All the pernicious problems of poverty were caused not by their inherent lack of judgmental morality, social relativity, blah, blah. No, it's because the jobs went away. And the jobs went away, leaving them bereft of hope with nothing to look forward to. And so they turned to different avenues of survival. And then he tweeted, and then he linked to this article that linked to David Brooks saying, it's weird how some people can look at the same evidence and come to this conclusion that somehow it's all about morality. But here's the problem with all these writers. And this is me speaking as the expert on David Brooks in the United States. I got to say, I'm probably the number one expert on David Brooks.
You've certainly America. Written more than anybody else. Yeah.
By a long shot. What these estimable writers all miss is the larger perspective. David Brooks is not writing a column or two columns or four columns. He's not doing it there and then going over the radio and television, et cetera. He's creating a what's the word I'm looking for? He's creating
a long narrative, a long form narrative. Yep. Yeah.
He's creating a complete, totalizing, inclusive, immersive, alternate history of the United States, mm-hmm. in which David Brooks was never wrong. Rush Limbaugh was never there. Phyllis Schlafly was never part of the Republican Party. It was always dirty hippies versus Whigs. It was always the 60s fucked up everything, and Whigs like David Brooks came along to clean it up. And by God, they've been trying really hard all along. That is David Brooks's version of reality. The problem, again, the problem very much like Rand Paul and very much like Tom Cotton, very much like John McCain. When David Brooks intersects with reality, he ends up looking like a complete simpleton. Like just the worst kind of douchebag huckster, you know, because obviously what he's selling is bullshit. What he's selling are lies. And at some level, he knows he's lying. So the reason he has taken his column in a moral direction, and then I talk a lot more morality and spiritually. No, the reason you're doing that, David Brooks, is because the pulpit is the last and most reliable refuge of con men.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you talk about math, Paul Krugman beats the shit out of you. If you talk about history, yeah. anybody who knows anything about the past, when you write entire tracts that completely omit the last 50 years to make your point, everyone knows you're lying. And of course, you're surrounded by cowards who will never call you out, and you're surrounded by bosses who are too ballless to call you out. So it's not like there's ever going to be any accountability, but you look stupid. Out there in the world, in the press, in the rest of the places where you don't yet control, you look like an imbecile. You look like an incompetent liar, and you look like a coward. So rather than face up to the fact that you don't know what you're talking about and you're selling bullshit, what you do is you invent an alternate universe where none of these things ever happen, none of them count, and you slide away from any area where you can be measured mm-hmm. by your own behavior by saying, you know what? I agree on accountability. Let's start with you.
Yep.
I agree people should be held to account for what they say and do. Let's start with what David Brooks has said and done, because that is a really dangerous place to go. So instead, you hide in the pulpit like millions of con men before you, like millions of con men after you. You hide out behind morality because you have no morality. And that's what David Brooks is all about. And that's the larger perspective that these very good writers never bring. It's the idea that when I do my posts, I pull stuff from David Brooks from the 90s, from back when he was working for Bill Kristol. Back when he was saying that the Bush tax cuts are the greatest thing that ever happened and we're never going to have deficits again. You know, David Brooks has been wrong for a really, really, really long time. It's just that none of his colleagues have any integrity at all. And so none of them are ever going to actually go back and click on a link that I will provide yep. to them that will show that it's all out there. It's not gone. It's not buried. If you had any interest at all in looking into this guy's past, you could see what a complete fraud he is. But nobody's interested, because once that emperor has no clothes, then people are going to be asking about Chuck Todd's apparel. And and look, Joe Scarborough has no pants. And suddenly all of them are being held to account for what they say and what they do and what they let people get away with. And they're not going to let that happen. So that's my
take. I want to go back to the economic situation that Paul Krugman was talking about and why this particular David Brooks column got so much attention is because we have had an experiment where when you take the middle class jobs away from a community, Drug use goes up, marriages go down, suicide among white men went way up compared to the African-American community. Actually, I was looking up on the CDC today about suicide, and the class and race of people who are least likely to commit suicide in the United States are African-American women. Mm-hmm. Isn't that interesting? And part of it is social network. They have a social network that supports one another. But the Republicans are having a lot of lady troubles. On the lower end of the intellectual spectrum in discussing this issue, not bringing up David Brooks, but outnumbered on Fox, which has one lucky guy in the middle of four miniskirted on-air talent. Let's call them that. Is that okay?
That's good. Yeah.
Andrea Tantaros, on-air talent.
Usually in places like this, there's a piano player in the parlor, but
not on this show. No. But they had to discuss why they wanted to discuss why people aren't getting married anymore. And they didn't blame rap music this time. No. They blamed the Tinder. And Tantaros piped in and said, it's because I'm reading this from Wonkette. Ladies now fuck everybody like men do because feminism makes the ladies into great big sluts who don't force the guys to put a ring on it. And when she says those words, she looks and sounds like she just dropped the big reveal in a TED talk about emotional health or sustainable farming or something. But not one goddamn time do they mention economics or housing or jobs or healthcare or anything that might make for a stable family. I've said this before, and I will say it again and again on this podcast. People don't get married until they have housing. And I'm going to add just a couple footnotes here, and then I want to get into talking about employment.
Yes.
The Texas legislators who put the words former fetus on their office door to describe themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure they put that on their resumes. They should.
Yeah.
Your brain is still a fetus, let me tell you.
Uh-huh.
Congress, the Republican Congress is having a problem because Candace Miller is retiring. She's the chairman of the House Administration Committee, and she's their only she's their only person of gender. She's the person of gender that is a committee chair among the Republicans, and they can't find another person of gender who will be able to be a chair lady. Uh-huh. I guess we'll call her chair lady.
Uh-huh.
They're having a hard time with that. So it's gonna look bad if they can't find another lady to be their person of gender. And otherwise, it'll be all white guys, you know, and that won't look good.
If I may just for a moment say that if Republicans are having a hard time finding ladies, they're having a very easy time finding the real racists.
Yeah. Oh, Joe Scarborough and Bill Kristol found the real racists this week, didn't he?
Yeah. The Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson of truth and integrity on television. And it's sort of like you and I are going to visit my mom.
Yeah. In a few weeks. Yeah.
And we're going to get an atomic cake. An atomic cake is a multiply layered confection that is available only in a very few places in Illinois. And
we're going to have it for a belated birthday party for your mother. Happy birthday, Mom. It's this week. And happy birthday, John Amato. It's this week, too, by the way. Crooks and Liars.
I hate to make a bad analogy, but
I'll eat a bite of atomic cake in your honor. And can we tell them what atomic cake, what the layers are? Because it's so good.
Please. It's cake and pudding and strawberries and bananas.
It's three flavors of cake. It's banana cake, chocolate cake, and yellow cake. Mm-hmm. And then yellow pudding with bananas and chocolate pudding with strawberries. And then it's all frosted over and it's like 17 inches high. And it's so good.
It's so good. And they only make it at Pearson's. And so that's where we'll be.
Yeah.
And I hate to analogize using one of my favorite childhood treats, but the layering of the of the amazing amount of I didn't even want to yell at Joe Scarborough or Bill Kristol. I wanted to go straight to Phil Griffin at MSNBC and just shake him by the lapels and say, and just because he's selling, I mean, he has commoditized liberalism and now he's remaindering it. Now he's tearing the cover off and selling it for a buck.
Mm-hmm.
He really is destroying that network. I mean, and I look at this show This morning.
How did Bill Kristol get on MSNBC to talk about rap music?
Step way back and say, how did Bill Kristol, one of the architects of the Iraq War, the most bloody, awful, hypocritical, snarling, rictus-faced monster, walk
the fucking
earth?
If we had one person
on
the whole planet to blame for Sarah Palin beside John McCain, it's Bill Kristol. And he discovered her. Yeah.
Former employer of David Brooks.
Yep.
How the hell does this guy ever leave the Weekly Standard bubble? But suddenly he's employee of the week over at the George Stephanopoulos show. He's a regular on a network television show. And of course, they never ask him about the fact, yeah, by the way, how does it feel to be an unreconstructed war criminal?
Mm-hmm.
That question never pops up. It's like on NBC. They have Paul Wolfowitz on, and Chuck Todd never raises the question. Well, by the way, why should we listen to you when you've been horribly, horribly wrong about getting other people's children killed every fucking time? Why were you rewarded for being such an incompetent coward and a liar and a douchebag by being given the presidency of the World Bank? No one ever asked that question. So clearly these people have magic powers over the network. So you flip on the television in the morning, and you see washed up high school jock Joe Scarborough.
Yeah.
Complete wingnut talking point Pez dispenser, who's been given 3 hours and more money than anybody else at MSNBC to be to kill that network from the morning up. Talking to Bill fucking Kristol about who the real racists are. Imagine, just think of all the different flavor combinations there are in there, about all the two people who should never be allowed on television, period. Yep. Being put together on the same stage to talk about one of the subjects they really, really shouldn't get anywhere near.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, they discover the real racists, and the real racists are black rappers. And
that's where those naughty words come from. It's from rap music. Yeah, those Oklahoma students were singing on the bus. No, those are actually pre-Civil War fraternity songs that were written by white people in Oklahoma They brag on the website of this fraternity that this fraternity is antebellum. You know, that the reason it's so great is it really is from the South.
It's from the South.
Untouched. The true untouched South. The real the South. Yeah.
By the war of Northern aggression. They were untouched by that.
Uh-huh.
And so, and of course, the third party to this table is Joe's little meat puppet, Mika.
Yeah.
You're right, Joe. Whatever you say, Joe. That's right, Joe. 3 hours of this bullshit every morning is what passes for liberal television.
But she tells her fellow millionaire New York City Manhattan denizens, you need to lean forward and ask for more money and be out there, you know, and not a word about homeless women veterans.
No, not a word of anything.
Yeah.
So the idea that you would have this perfect trifecta of, oh, God, Joe Scarborough and Bill Kristol talking about race on liberal television. I don't write about this anymore. I don't write about MSNBC. What I do mention occasionally is the fact that the next time the good and great Dr. Rachel Maddow wants to get up on her soapbox and bitch about the media and how do these people keep getting on television, I will repeat this for the 50th time. And at some point, I know people at MSNBC listen to this podcast. I don't know if they communicate this to her, but... And I know the reason why, but I have to ask it anyway. The next time you get indignant that Paul Wolfowitz or Bill Kristol or Doug Feith or any of these other unreconstructed Iraq war scumbags get asked back on television to be asked about anything, don't make it a rhetorical question. Go down the hall 50 feet, put a camera on Joe Scarborough's desk and ask him the question. But that's never going to happen, is it?
Yeah.
It's never going to happen. And that makes me very sad.
She'll lose her job.
She'll lose her job.
Yep.
Boom. Next day, she'll be gone and be replaced by, I don't know. not Joanne Reed, that's for sure. I don't know. I'm sure there's a Republican congressman out there who needs a job, and I'm sure that Phil Griffith would be happy to give it to him.
Well, if Aaron Schock has to resign, he's pretty enough for TV. He could be on there in a heartbeat.
You know who's not going to get that job? Me, Blue Gal. I'm allergic to work.
Drift Class was laid off by his main job that provides us with health insurance this week. Those of you who aren't on Facebook, I'm very appreciative. Facebook just saved my soul this week with all the kind comments that people left me. And it's just the first half of the week. I'm glad it happened on Monday, although being laid off on a Monday is pretty awful. But I'm glad it happened so that you and I had some time to breathe in between now and then. We got back on the exchange, and as far as I know, we are in the process of purchasing health insurance from a new insurance company. Mm-hmm. I have to say, Driftglass, I don't think I will ever vote in our family for us going back on employer-sponsored health care ever again.
No?
Because it's too stressful. It's too stressful to switch. And we lose money every time we switch because your year-to-date spending when you switch insurance companies goes back to zero. So we are actually losing money every time we have to change jobs. And I wonder if that isn't in the DNA of, you know, thank God for Obamacare. Thank God we can just get insurance right away without a lapse. But hell, you know, maybe the design as far as corporations are concerned is, look, they're going to people are going to realize when they get laid off for the, what is this now, fifth time in 6 years for
I've
you?
I've been laid off 5 times in 6 years.
Yeah.
Yep. 5 times.
It's not worth it to take the employer-sponsored health insurance because by the time you have no guarantee of a job 6 months from now if you get hired. And then you have to go through this rigmarole. And the real scary part for me is Medicaid for the kids. Yep. I've been told they're eligible. And it's right this second as I speak. It's a black hole. I've applied, but I don't know whether they have a 7-month backlog. And I'm going to breathe now that.
Yep. Take a breath, darling. Take a breath.
Whew. Uh-huh. Finding, making sure that they have insurance is really critical. So
It is. It's more important than anything, frankly.
Yeah.
They
have medications and special needs and real issues. So it's expensive. So I want to make sure we get that taken care of. And we are taking steps to do that, even if it means we have to buy a month of Cobra. we're gonna make it happen. So.
Well, and that's I realize that we are in good company.
Oh yeah. And there were a number of people on Facebook who said that, you know, just been there or I am there or I can't find a insurance company in my on the exchange that any provider in my town will take, thing.
And I got to say my wife is formidable. When it comes to doing battle with the frankly inept staff or really just overwhelmed staff, grossly understaffed Illinois Healthcare Exchange.
Yeah.
Because you had to walk them all the way back to the last time they fucked up.
Yep. The short version is I had such a battle with the health insurance company that we bought on the exchange last April that I have a case number with the Department of Health and Human Services.
Yes, you do.
Let's put it that way. I have a case number with the Department of Health and Human Services
and yet,
in Washington, D.C.
And yet you have better records than they do.
Yes, I do.
Because you walked them back and said, no, this is where you got it wrong.
Here's my case number.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah, yeah, that's right. Oh, yeah. And again, down the most awful memory lane I don't want to go down. But
I wanted to open a vein at that point. I really did. I was
And we got our health care on the exchange after 6 months of arm wrestling.
With Medicaid. Yeah.
Medicaid. And just trying to find anyone. And this is, again, this is the time where you took the folder to them and gave it to them. And they lost it. And you had to go back and say, I walked this all the way up to your goddamn desk last time and you lost it. So how about we go all the way through the process this time? And then you find the poor schlub in the back who's got two mountains of files.
Mm-hmm. He had a stack of files on his floor as tall as my 10-year-old. Yep. Yep.
And that's and our new governor, Governor Hedge Fund, has decided that what he really thinks is wrong with this state is the poor have had it way too good for way too long. And we need to cut some of that shit some more because he's never had to handle a case file. He's never had to handle someone who has no health insurance or it had their fuel shut off, et cetera. And so you and I had a really delicate moment, I would say.
I would say so.
because you were beside yourself with anger.
Yeah,
but it was over the fact that imagine all those people who don't have the resources we have.
That was what I was crying about.
Navigate this fucked up system that is designed to make them fail. It is designed to trick you and trap you and fool you and snare you into failing
or to just giving up. Because if I had a full-time job or two part-time jobs, I would not have time to do this. I would not have time to be on the phone with the healthcare exchange for 3 hours on Tuesday, which I was. Mm-hmm. So, or online trying to fill out an application. And it, really, it took me from 9 until noon until I was finally off the phone and said, okay, I've done everything I can do for today to try to get health insurance. And people who are poor and working 3 jobs or 2 jobs and have kids and
are exhausted.
Give up. They just give up. And I don't blame them. But that is what makes me the most depressed about this, because I know I have resources. I have mental resources. I can write a letter. I can file an appeal. I can get an attorney if I have to. I mean, it would be hard to do that. It would be hard to pay for that. But if I really had to get an attorney to fight an insurance company, I could do that. That would be within my wheelhouse to do. And there are so many people in this world who just do not have that kind of resources, those kind of emotional and intellectual resources is what I'm talking about, let alone money, you know.
And from the perspective of the employed one or now unemployed one, part of what curses me or haunts me is my job used to be finding work for people.
Yeah. Yep.
I was really good at it. I was really good at lots of things.
Well, and job training for nonprofits. You've worked for nonprofits and tried to find job training for people who really were those people who lacked resources, lacked ways to get access to education, access to transportation for jobs, et cetera. And you're one of the good guys who really wants to help. You've been behind that desk with the stack of files trying to help.
I have. And I've been on the phone with companies. I've been trying to line up all kinds of things. And the part of the thing that is sort of cursed knowledge is I know what the odds are for a person such as myself over the age of, say, 45, who has been laid off 5 times in 6 years.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It looks like a terminal cancer diagnosis on your resume.
Yeah, yeah.
It's, oh, why can't you keep a job? And going through and saying, well, look, this job,
they ran out of money.
The HR person was in tears and said, you know, my God, you know, if only we could keep you, but we can't. The last job was, I know you warned us not to stick our dick in the light socket, but we did. And now we've destroyed everything. So, now we have no funding. And, but the person we're going to get rid of is you.
Yeah.
And I don't even ask anymore. I mean, I was joking to Plugal. I got really good at being fired.
Yeah.
I now pay attention to the details of each termination in case I ever want to write a book on what it's like to be fired over and over and over again. But it is this weird process by which in every case, I have been one of the exemplary people at the organization.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I have to walk out of the office past people who are paste eaters, who are keeping their job, people who are.
I love that you called David Brooks a paste eater this week, too. I like paste. That's why I write for the New York Times. I feel like it's a Jimmy Kimmel or Jimmy Fallon, Fallon character. His the girl, the blonde girl who says, I write for the New York Times because I like to eat paste.
That's very expensive paste, David Brooks. This is the part, you know, everybody gets fired. Everybody gets fired. Everybody loses a job every now and then. But at some point, it happens so often, and it's so complete. You know, it's what I know is this is stuff that happens far away. There's no negotiating. There's no discussing. You're never going to meet the person who made the decision. This is dealing with Governor Hedge Fund. He doesn't want to talk to the people he's getting rid of. He doesn't want to have anything to do with them. Everybody below this line, everybody to the left of this side of the room is gone. And what I've come to realize, which is really dangerous for me to harbor this knowledge, but it's also true. It literally stopped mattering how good I was or capable or how hard you try or how many times you knock on the door or how much you can contribute. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. None of that is entered into the calculation when it comes time to getting rid of you. You're either in the club or you're not. And if you're not in the club, you're gone.
Well, and several people on Facebook mentioned the change that has happened in terms of employees over the course of the past 50 years. And one person said that she had gotten a job that the manager in an all staff meeting said, employees are our most valuable resource.
Yeah.
And she said, I made plans to quit that job during that meeting because a resource is something you use up and spend. and then you can get rid of it if it starts to become a liability. And another person said that, you know, they had worked in their last job and were retired, but their last job was 1967 when he had a pension, you know, and job security. And you didn't fire somebody after 6 months. I mean, you were in that job for just over 6 months, Driftglass.
Yep. And I think they're so terrified. This is one of the places that Governor Hedge Fund, one of the many, 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 many organizations that his axe is falling upon. So it's one of those cases where I can't even get mad about it.
Yeah.
I'm just bumfuzzled at how organizations get run these days.
At some point, we keep saying, you know, eventually the Fox News audience is going to die off. And eventually this way of treating employees is going to turn around and just bite them right on the ass. Because the young generation of workers that's coming up doesn't want money for anything but paying their phone bill and their car insurance, because that's all they've ever been given. And they have get out of college. You can't afford a house. You can't afford a family. All you can afford is to live with your mom and dad, pay your phone, pay your car insurance. And that's considered independence if you can do those two things.
Mm-hmm.
So having a commitment to a company, having a commitment to a mission of a company is just totally foreign to this generation that's coming up. They have no need for it.
Well, and let me point out, I want to just add to that one thing. This is the generation that's come up to and seen their fathers laid
exactly,
off.
Exactly, exactly.
Their fathers and mothers screwed by corporations, mm-hmm. and their fathers and mothers' pensions stolen by corporations,
yep.
and their futures destroyed by companies. They have absolutely no faith in the corporate bullshit. These are very smart, very capable, fun to be around, and will nod through the corporate presentation, but aren't buying a fucking word of it because they know it's nonsense. They know it's absolutely nonsense. They know that when the lifeboats, when the ship hits it's the iceberg, lifeboats are going to those 10 people over there. Everybody else is going to drown. And the way things are going, we're heading right for the iceberg, and nobody wants to turn the ship around because that means making a decision, and we don't do that around here.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not stupid. They're extremely perceptive about the world that they actually live in, not the ones that are on the brochure.
I'm going to end this episode with a Bible bitch.
Bible bitch.
That's not scriptural. I've been reading Psalms this week. We're reading the Bible in a year, but one of the ways we do it is skip through. And I want David in the book of Psalms, you know, he wrote the Psalms.
Yeah.
I want him to be played by the actor who played Jesse Pinkman.
Aaron Paul?
Aaron Paul.
Yeah.
Because David in Psalms so often is just a whiny little bitch. He's young and he's whiny and he wants what he wants when he wants it. And God isn't good enough to him. And, you know, shut up, bitch. You could just hear him with that tone of voice. But every so often, there's this ray of light, and I love the way this particular verse is translated by the Message. The message is written in modern English, and I just thought that this particular verse, Psalm 31:6, in this modern translation, would be an appropriate coda for many of our listeners. And I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. The verse is, I hate all this silly religion, but you, God, I trust. I'll leave you with that.
Yeah. Oh, I'd like to direct everyone, go read the article in Salon by Patton Oswalt.
Oh, yeah.
It's really good. It's really, really good. There's no point in going into it now. It's too long. You know, he's a mouthy guy, but it's really, really worth your time. And let me just say that. For free, for you, Patton. So quit bothering me, Patton Oswalt. I'm throwing traffic your way, so get off my back, man.
Leave me alone. I also wanted to read three sentences. Jamie over at Crooks and Liars just sent this via email. Uh-huh. It's an editorial in a newspaper. I'm not going to tell you which paper, but it's an editorial. And here are the first three sentences of the editorial. It will be up to history to judge whether the latest partisan stunt by the U.S. Senate amounts to an act of end times warmongering or merely another bit of cringeworthy buffoonery on the global stage. Chances are that the foolish, dangerous, and arguably felonious attempt by the Obama Derangement Caucus of the Senate will soon be forgotten, unless, as President Obama himself muttered the other day, the Senate Republicans make common cause with the hardliners in Iran to push the region and the world that much closer to nuclear war.
Wow.
Now, you want to guess which paper that was that wrote that editorial?
It wasn't the Tribune, I'll tell you that.
The Chicago Tribune?
Yeah.
You mean? No, it was the Tribune. It was the Salt Lake City Tribune in Utah. That liberal rag.
Wow, that bastion. Wow. That's and spot on.
And they called on, I edited a little bit, they called out Utah Senators Mike Lee and Orrin Hatch as having joined the latest partisan stunt. And I left that out to shade it a little bit. But Salt Lake City Tribune calling out their senators as engaging in a foolish campaign.
Well, if I may add to that, one thing, one sentence.
Mm-hmm.
What I tweeted yesterday, and I haven't written a lot of correspondence recently because I've just had the wind kind of taken out of me. But I will. I'm going to write thank you notes to all the nice people. I wrote something to the effect of, yeah, you remember that time when all those conservatives climbed down out of the stupid tree because facts proved them wrong? Yeah, neither do I.
Yeah, well, so, and that was the point of this editorial when they said, look, this chances are this will all be forgotten because Clinton emails.
Yeah.
It'll be something look shiny thing next week.
Have you noticed anybody talking about Bill O'Reilly this
week? Nope.
Holding him responsible, maybe getting him off the air and holding people.
Well, I do think that there is a concerted effort among the Congress to get people to forget that they failed to pass the Keystone XL pipeline, because somebody is out there that wants to cut their legs off for failing to do that and break a kneecap. Somebody wants to break Mitch McConnell's kneecaps over that, because he promised when they got the Senate that they'd be able to do something about that one thing. And that was their top priority in December. But as soon as they took the oath of office in January, they were going to pass this thing and they were going to get her done. And they failed. They failed. They failed. They failed. And there is an accounting coming for that if they don't change the subject real quick.
And you will atone.
On that note, each week we post to our Facebook page and website an Internet Kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's Internet Kitty is Nitnoi, which is Thai for little shit. You can send your Internet Kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com. And I really ask you to please send them that way rather than via Facebook or Twitter or whatever. Email them to us. proleftpodcast@gmail.com. You just send us a picture and I'll take care of the rest. You can also write to both of us at that address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com. Feel free to write us. We love hearing from you. We really do, don't we?
We really do.
Does our hearts a world of good to hear from you. Be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service. Go Postal Unions! Letter on the air unless you say otherwise. Don't forget our gourmet coffee guideline. If you can afford to buy an espresso-based beverage for yourself, buy one for us, although we will not buy coffee with it. We'll pay our electric bill.
Ah.
Approximately 1% of our listeners support this podcast with a contribution. You can, too. And you know, if you are like us and unemployed and struggling with insurance and so forth, this podcast is still our gift to you.
Absolutely.
But if you have a job and you listen every week, we would appreciate a contribution. See our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, for details on how you can donate. Please rate our show on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. And thank you. So, Drift Class, how are the Internet Kitties doing this week?
Well, Bluegal, in hindsight, the Internet Kitties regret spending every dollar in our bank account on an Apple Watch.
It's from Apple. I thought it would be intuitive.
Yeah.
Let's think about living. Think about living. Let's think about loving. Think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey dovin'. Let's forget about the whine and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with a switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
The Professional Left Podcast is recorded under Creative Commons license. Copyright 2015, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast.
Minecraft is awesome. Now it's time for Science Fiction University with our science fiction expert, Driftglass.
Science Fiction University, I gotta say, first of all, we're so sorry Terry Pratchett passed away.
Yes, we are.
And we're so sorry Leonard Nimoy passed away. A couple people said, why haven't you mentioned Leonard Nimoy? And it's because he passed away on a Friday morning when we were putting the podcast out a couple weeks ago. And we put it on our Facebook page, and you blogged about it, and I put it on Crooks and Liars and tweeted and on and on. And by the time we got to the following Friday, it's like, well, we've talked about this 17 times. So,
yeah, but not in this venue.
But not in this venue. So I was trying to come up with, for you, Driftglass, some Spock trivia. And
good luck with that.
Well, Spock trivia, it is really interesting. There's just two sets of Spock trivia.
Uh-huh.
There's super, super easy, where if you're a Trekker like you and I are, you automatically know all this stuff. And then there's questions like, what was the serial number of the tricorder in the animated series when Spock talked to McCoy that one time when the door was closed? I know that one. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
I know that one. I know that one. Yeah. I don't know that one.
No, we don't know that one. So they just run in those two streams, and I didn't think that would make for a very entertaining show. So
there's a market for middle tier Spock trivia, is what you're saying.
I don't know how you would come up with that, though.
Oh, I have some ideas.
Okay, well, you get right on that in your spare time.
Can I tell you a Harlan Ellison story involving Leonard Nimoy?
Sure.
They were pals, first of all. Actually, he and Leonard Nimoy, I believe, saved among the many, many, many other good deeds that they performed together and individually. They saved a bunch of wetlands up in California.
Ah.
Where Edgar Rice Burroughs, I believe, picnicked. And they went to the town council, and they went together, and they saved some valuable wetlands from developers, which is something people used to do in this country.
Yeah.
But there's a story about Leonard Nimoy's ears. I'll tell you very quickly.
Okay.
It's sort of how corporations behave. This is the week I got laid off, by the way. So it's sort
We're going to talk. We will have talked about that in the podcast. Yes.
So Leonard Nimoy originally apparently was going to have round ears.
Oh.
And then they had pointy ears. And then some enterprising reporter found out about the round ears originally and found a photograph of it. And asked, like, so what was the deal? And apparently there was, like, some incredible amount of corporate denial. Oh, no, that never happened. No, we were always going to go with the pointy ears. It was never. And it was such a trivial, stupid thing, but nobody wanted to take ownership that they might have screwed up. They might have gotten it wrong out of the gate and fixed it later. So it went, like, right up the chain of command until they found some guy in the art department and fired him.
Oh, man.
Because somebody has to take the fall for this, and it sure as shit's not going to be me.
Yep.
And this was straight out of the Glass Teat or The Other Glass Teat, which were Harlan Ellison's books on television criticism. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I'm sure there's a million and one great Nimoy stories. That's one of the ones I know secondhand. So farewell, Leonard Nimoy.
Yeah. And you and I watched that they had, you know, on a Star Trek marathon in honor of Leonard Nimoy on This TV, one of our networks on our cable system.
One of the nostalgia television.
One of the nostalgia TV stations. And they ran one of my favorite episodes, which is Amok Time.
Yes.
Which has the best villainous, Star Trek villainous of all time, T'Pring. What a bitch.
Yeah.
And I did not realize, and I don't think you realized either, that Ted Sturgeon wrote that episode.
No, I did. I knew he'd written one about shore leave.
Uh-huh.
But I didn't realize he'd written that one. And it makes perfect sense.
It's very rich episode about Vulcan. I mean, it really reveals a lot about Spock. He's the center of that episode.
It's Vulcan and its love and its friendship and its passion. And it's really a very, very good episode. Very, very good episode. And something that, you know, a religious cultural secret that they don't like to talk about, which is always a very rich subject of inquiry.
And then I learned today from looking up Leonard Nimoy trivia that the hand symbol of the Vulcans came out of that episode, which was developed with Leonard Nimoy and his Jewish heritage and so forth.
Yeah. Yep.
But Live Long and Prosper.
Yeah.
Was written into that episode. And Ted Sturgeon is responsible for that. I had no idea.
Yeah.
So there you go. Ted Sturgeon. There's some science fiction trivia for you.
So drop a little truth on us, Blue Gal.
And so I also want to thank Raymond, our friend Raymond, who has sent us over the course of many, many packages. A great number of Terry Pratchett books.
Yes.
And we appreciate having those in our collection. But also thank Dogface Herman, who this week really bailed me out. I went through my emails trying to figure out if there were some Dogface Herman science fiction universities that we had not used yet. And my brain just kind of shut down. Like, I don't know whether we've used these or not. So I wrote to him this morning, and we are recording this on Thursday during the day, and said, help, I don't know if we've used any of these. He said, oh, let me just send you a new one. So, okay, here you go. So that was awesome, and thank you. And he said he's got a couple more in the can, so we're in good shape. Thank you.
Awesome.
Dogface Herman.
Two little addenda to this segment. Mm-hmm. First of all, I can recommend unreservedly Good Omens, which is Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman. It's it's a hilarious novel and very funny. And the subtitle, The Nice and Accurate Prophecies of Agnes Nutter, Witch. And it was just, it's a beautiful, hilarious story about the end of the world.
Okay.
And and my mom gave it to me originally. So, you know, it comes with
hilarious story about the end of the world. Yeah. There's a lot of that going on.
With impeccable pedigree. And the second one was, we got a request, sort of via Twitter, that in addition to science fiction, perhaps we could spend some time at some future date talking about Westerns.
Yeah, because you like Westerns.
You like Westerns.
You really do like Westerns. And someone was mentioning the horseless Western on Twitter. What's a horseless Western?
The Matrix.
The Matrix is a horseless Western. Okay, all right.
Anything where you have the tropes of the Western, the types of setups, the types of plot lines. I've never read Louis L'Amour, for example, so I can't tell you anything about the ancient, the grand and good old days of odors.
Mm-hmm.
I watched very little of the silent age of Westerns, but I have a pretty good amateur knowledge of Westerns going back to Stagecoach, which I believe you wrote a paper on.
I wrote a paper on, and I shocked my teacher. I wrote about things he's seen that movie. He's taught that movie hundreds of times. And he said, you told me things about that movie that I had never thought about before. So, yeah, that was fun. John Wayne never kisses the girl.
Yeah.
Because a John never kisses his whore.
That's right.
So,
that's right.
You know, I don't think that was the thought. But there is no kiss in that movie.
No.
Yeah. Yeah, there is no kiss in that movie.
And that movie is based on what classic English novel?
I don't know.
Really?
Really? What?
One of the original great tales of literature. A group of travelers.
King Arthur. Oh, really? It's Canterbury Tales?
I swear it must be.
Oh, come on, really?
Because look at the people who are in there, right?
Yeah, you've got the whore, the minister, the crook, and the barber, and the cowboy. Yeah. Well.
So, it's not a horseless Western, but it's a Western.
Mm-hmm.
So a horseless Western would be one where the scene from The Matrix where they're in the subway. Where there's literally whistling in the background.
Yeah, and tumbleweed.
It's
actually almost tumbleweed out.
It's a gunfight.
Yeah, it is.
So there's a lot of modern Westerns. There's a lot of things that use Western tropes. Star Trek was sold to as a series as Wagon Train in Space.
Yep. Yeah.
So, but if there's any interest in that out there, we'd be happy to change it up a little bit. I love science fiction. I can talk about it all day and all night, and often do to the
well, maybe we do a science fiction university on the horseless Western and talk about all of the science fiction stories that actually are Westerns. That would be kind of fun.
It's basically Robert Heinlein.
Another opportunity for you to, for our audience to take a drink.
Yeah, everybody. Okay. I'm just giving them away now. Anyway, on with our quiz. Thanks to the awesome Dogface Herman.
Yes, Dogface Herman says name the show or movie, and then these clips have something in common.
Uh-huh.
The last clip is the odd man out in some respects. You have to tell us why. All right.
Okay.
So
see how
this goes. Number one.
Impossible. Dead.
I'd say it got better.
It's been modified.
Oh, you think?
What the hell is going on?
Jason fucking Voorhees, that's what's going on.
I have no idea, but I'm tempted to say something with Steven Spielberg, because that music, I swear that music is the same music from Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Hmm.
The temple music, you know, when there's a big reveal in the temple. I swear that's the same music, but I couldn't tell you.
It's actually one of the Jason movies, but it's Jason in space. It's Jason X.
Because everything's better in space.
2001, yeah. Jason goes to space. Yes. Okay.
Why wouldn't we have that?
Speaking of music, here's one I think you'll get. Number two.
Huh? Yeah, okay. That's little Anakin Skywalker getting his ass burned off. And,
what's wrong with your face?
Yeah, yeah. Being put into his super suit.
That's right.
Where's my super suit? That's what he basically, what he says off camera all the time to his wife.
Mm-hmm.
My super suit. But that's the birth of Darth Vader.
That's the birth of Darth Vader in that very, very bad movie. Okay. Number three.
Why y'all look like you seen a ghost? It's me, dear friends. Alive and kicking. Well, alive anyway. We may have lost the war, but heaven knows we haven't lost our sense of humor. No, not even when we lost a lung, a spleen, a bladder, two legs, 35 feet of small intestine, and our ability to reproduce all in the name of the South. Do we ever lose our sense of humor?
Oh. Jesus, I have no idea.
Well, speaking of Westerns, this is Wild Wild West with the Confederate.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, but that, no, see, that's not fair. Because
Arliss
no,
Loveless.
Loveless was just a little person.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't have any limbs lost. He was, and that was, by the way, who the hell? It wasn't Billy Barty.
Michael Dunn played Megalito Loveless.
Yeah. And he was off. He was just.
Yeah, because he was in Star Trek, too. Yeah, yeah, that's yeah. Right.
He sank his teeth into the role of being a really good villain who loved being evil. He just loved what he was doing. And I don't remember any specific scenes other than I just took a lot of pleasure in watching him do his thing. Anyway, so, okay, got that one wrong. My apologies. But I'm sensing a theme.
All right, number four.
Murphy, I'm a mess.
They'll fix you. They fixed everything.
Oh, come on. That's RoboCop.
And Grog Pasterman says, can you tell that I like this movie? Yeah. You put this RoboCop in just about every science fiction university. Yeah, in fact, we should make that a take a drink. Anytime Dogface Terman puts RoboCop in a science fiction university, you got to take a drink. Okay.
You got to take a sip of baby food. And can you tell me why? Yeah.
All right. Number five.
Our race was getting weak.
Weak? How?
Our lifespan was getting shorter, so our scientists and doctors devised spare parts for our bodies until we could be almost completely replaced.
But that means you're not like us. You're robots.
Our brains are just like yours, except that certain weaknesses have been removed.
Weaknesses? What weaknesses?
You call them emotions, do you not?
Oh, that's vintage Doctor Who. That's old school Doctor Who. Mm-hmm. That's the Cybermen.
That's the Cybermen. The last William Hartnell story and the first appearance of the Cybermen. Yeah. Doctor Who, the 10th Planet, 1966.
All right. Then since I'm sensing a theme here, the next one either has to be Army of Darkness or something with the Borg.
Okay. Number six.
I've extracted 82% of the Borg hardware. The remaining bioimplants are stable and better than anything I could synthesize at such short notice.
It is acceptable.
Yeah, see? Told you. That's Voyager. That's Star Trek Voyager. And it's something with the Borg, something with Seven of Nine.
So these have a common theme.
Yeah. And that's why it had to be Army of Darkness or something with the Borg. It was people who have prosthetics or cybernetic organisms or cyborgs or a part machine or something like that.
Right. And in the last clip, the machine is being removed, or most of it is being removed in Seven of Nine. So that's the... And the reason you say Army of Darkness is because...
Bruce Campbell has
an arm.
That's chainsaw hand, man.
Chainsaw, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. You can't get much more useful cybernetic add-on than a chainsaw hand.
Driftglass, I love you.
Love you, too.
Very happily married. And yes. We'll talk to you guys next week. Bye.
Bye, everybody. Bye.